The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter. I'm finishing the Harvard Heart Letter of March 2025. I'm sorry, the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is entitled, How to Cope with Worsening Allergy Seasons. It's not your imagination. As the climate changes, allergy season is starting earlier every year, lasting longer and blanketing us with more pollen. How is this phenomenon making allergy seasons harsher, and how can you cope? Most scientists believe that the primary cause of climate change is a rise in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is a consequence of burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. Carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases trap heat, and as a result, we are seeing increasing temperatures, also known as global warming, says Dr. Amanda Dilger, who studies the effect of climate change on ear, nose, and throat health, and is an ENT surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Global warming is affecting the way plants use energy and grow. Plants like the ragweed, a common fall allergen, and grass, a late spring and summer allergen, now have longer growing seasons. They are producing higher amounts of pollen and are growing in new geographic locations, Dr. Dilger says. For example, a study published in PNAS found that nationwide pollen levels increased 21% between 1990 and 2018. The longer allergy season poses several problems. One is that increased pollen levels might worsen outdoor air quality and cause new or more intense seasonal allergy symptoms. Dr. Dilger notes, another issue is that it can be harder to predict when your allergies might crank up and when you should begin preparing for them with medications and nasal sprays, which is typically a month in advance of when you anticipate symptoms. Starting early helps to ward them off. A changing allergy season might also make it harder to discern the difference between allergy symptoms and upper respiratory illness, causing you to delay treatment. Dr. Dilger suggests paying attention to daily pollen counts and taking an over-the-counter allergy medication if symptoms seem to get worse when the outdoor air quality changes and improve with medication. That's a telltale sign that your allergies are flaring. Rougher allergy seasons aren't a fluke, they're the new normal, and you're probably going to have to do more to navigate them than you did before. Dr. Dilger advises taking as many of the following steps as possible. If you have any new or worsening symptoms, including nasal congestion, runny nose, and facial pressure, check with your healthcare provider to see if symptoms are due to allergies or other nasal issues like a sinus infection. It's especially important to call your provider if you have symptoms of an infection like fever, general discomfort, or fatigue, facial pain, or discolored nasal discharge. Avoid allergy triggers by staying indoors with the windows closed, especially on days with strong winds, high pollen counts, or both. Minimize outdoor activities that can increase your pollen exposure, like gardening and lawn mowing, when pollen counts in your community are high. if you're going to be outside for more than a few minutes, wear a disposable mask and throw it out when you're back indoors. Toss your clothes in the wash and take a shower to rinse pollen from your skin and hair. Check outdoor air quality in your area using the Air Quality Index. If high pollen counts or poor air quality are in the forecast, start taking your allergy medication before your symptoms start, Dr. Dilger advises. When indoors, run the air conditioning with a high-efficiency particulate air filter, called a HEPA filter, and use a dehumidifier to help reduce allergens and humidity. For more information, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Controlling Your Allergies, which is available at www.health.harvard.edu/ALL. Now we're going to turn to another article in the Harvard Health Letter. And this article is entitled, Is It Time for a CPAP Checkup? Of course, CPAP is capital C, capital P, capital A, capital P. To get the best result from your sleep apnea therapy, you'll need to check in with your healthcare provider regularly. Ever since your obstructive sleep apnea diagnosis, you've tried to use your CPAP machine faithfully. Hopefully, it's restored your ability to sleep without snoring, coughing, choking, or suffering dozens of pauses in breathing per hour. Perhaps it helps you feel more alert, awake, and productive, and has begun to lower the risk of dangerous consequences related to sleep apnea, like high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, and depression. But the gentle hum of the CPAP device doesn't guarantee that the therapy is working effectively. Like a sensitive medication regimen, it needs to be assessed and monitored regularly. What is CPAP therapy? CPAP therapy prevents your upper airways from being blocked by throat muscles that relax too much during sleep. The therapy involves a small bedside compressor that pumps a forceful stream of air through a tube and into your nose by a mask you wear all night. A standard CPAP machine delivers a fixed air pressure, while an auto CPAP machine automatically adjusts pressure based on your varying needs throughout the night, such as when you change position or shift into a new sleep stage. Your healthcare provider must prescribe the therapy. You then obtain the system through a medical equipment supplier. A technician from the supplier will work with you to find the right mask, set the specified air pressure settings to keep your airway open without disturbing your sleep, and answer ongoing questions about using the system. You can control the temperature and humidity of the air entering the mask. Additionally, you can choose how fast the air pressure increases. You can set it to ramp up over 5 minutes or 45 minutes, or select the auto ramp setting and have the machine adjust the pace automatically based on your breathing, explains Dr. Karen Lee, a neurologist and sleep medicine specialist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. For CPAP therapy to be covered by insurance, you're required to see your healthcare provider 30 to 90 days after you start using the system. The clinician always needs to ensure that the CPAP has improved and hopefully resolved your sleep issues, Dr. Lee says. And what can be complicated is that you may not be aware of some of your sleep issues. Sleep apnea often increases the frequency of nighttime urination, grinding or clenching your teeth, and night sweats. The clinician needs to ask appropriate questions to understand if your sleep is optimized while using CPAP. At your first checkup, your provider will review data that the machine has been collecting. The machine tells us when you're using the device and estimates how many apnea episodes you're having per hour, when you're struggling to breathe, and whether air is leaking out of your mouth or around the mask unintentionally, Dr. Lee says. Based on that information and your own observations, your clinician might prescribe a higher or lower air pressure. You might need to go back for additional visits and adjustments until the kinks are ironed out, which can take a few months. You may even require an overnight study in the sleep lab while using CPAP to help clarify any issues. Once the CPAP system is working for you, you'll need to have it reevaluated once a year to see if the air pressure needs to be adjusted. These continuing follow-up appointments are important for many reasons. Dr. Lee says the CPAP machine provides only estimated information, which sometimes is inaccurate. She needs to compare it with insights from a patient visit to determine if the CPAP really is helping. Everything sags as we get older, even the airway, which causes the disease to advance over time. Gaining weight can make sleep apnea worse. Losing weight can make it better or even make it disappear. Either could potentially affect the pressure settings. Dr. Lee says that the brain sometimes reacts to CPAP in a way that creates another type of apnea. In that case, the settings or the actual device need to be changed. Also, Dr. Lee says, we need to make sure all of your sleep needs are being addressed, especially if you have other sleep disorders like insomnia, restless legs, or sleepiness despite effective CPAP treatment. Unfortunately, many people don't get regular CPAP checkups. If you're among them, it could be that your clinician never told you you need periodic assessments. While any healthcare provider can prescribe the therapy, they don't all know how to adjust it optimally or that they should evaluate it regularly, Dr. Lee says. Or you might not be getting CPAP checkups because you feel better and don't think you need additional assessments, or you don't think the therapy is effective and have given up on it, or your schedule is too hectic. Or you assume mistakenly that the medical equipment supplier is monitoring your health. If you've never had your CPAP use evaluated or haven't done so in a long time, Dr. Lee advises making an appointment with a sleep specialist or with the expert who prescribed the therapy. Dr. Lee also recommends calling your clinician anytime new health problems or symptoms affect sleep. Come see me if you start snoring again, or if you're tired despite using the machine. If you have any questions, they need to be asked. Now we're going to turn to some news briefs that are included in the Harvard Health Letter of March 2025. And the first of these is more evidence that plant-based diets might ward off heart problems. You might consider this while you're planning meals. A Harvard study suggests that boosting the share of plant-based protein in the diet is linked to significantly lower risks of heart and blood vessel problems. These findings were published in the December 2024 issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Researchers evaluated health and lifestyle information reported by 200,000 people followed for 30 years. Compared to participants whose diets had the lowest ratio of plant protein to animal protein, those with the highest ratio had a 19% lower risk of developing cardiovascular disease and a 27% lower risk of developing coronary disease. People who replaced red and processed meat with plant sources also had lower risks for stroke. The study results don't say that animal protein needs to be eliminated, just that its share should be reduced for most people. Sources of plant-based protein include legumes, nuts, seeds, and whole grains. Here's another brief article from the News Briefs. Fluctuating sleep times might boost your heart attack and stroke risk. Does your sleep schedule vary through the week with different bedtime and wake-up times? If so, you might be boosting your risk for a heart attack or another major cardiovascular problem, according to a study published online by the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. The research involved more than 72,000 healthy people who wore sleep trackers on their wrist for a week and were then followed for 8 years. Compared with people whose sleep patterns fluctuated the least, those whose sleep pattern fluctuated the most had a 26% higher risk of having heart failure, a heart attack, a stroke, or a related problem, even if they got the recommended amount of sleep. The study was observational and doesn't prove conclusively that irregular sleep causes cardiovascular events. However, many previous studies have found that irregular sleep is tied to increased risk for heart disease and diabetes. And finally, there's a brief article that says, "Can dark chocolate help you avoid diabetes?" As if we need another reason to love chocolate, a Harvard study suggests that eating the sweet treat is tied to a lower risk of diabetes. But the particular type of chocolate matters. Scientists evaluated the self-reported dietary and health information of 112,000 healthy middle-aged people who were followed for more than 30 years. Compared with people who rarely or never ate chocolate, those who had at least 5 ounces of dark chocolate per week had a 21% lower risk of developing diabetes. There were no significant diabetes risk reductions among people who ate milk chocolate. In fact, that treat was tied to weight gain, which can eventually boost diabetes risk. What's the magic of dark chocolate? Even though it has about the same amount of saturated fat and calories as milk chocolate, dark chocolate is lower in sugar and much richer in flavanols. Plant chemicals known to have health benefits, like antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects, plus cardiometabolic perks, changes that help your body pump blood and use food for energy. The authors suspect that the flavanols might offset the effects of dark chocolate's fat and sugar content, although more research is needed to confirm this. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Women's Health Watch. This is the Harvard Women's Health Watch of March 2025. And I'm going to start with the Ask the Doctor section. This is with Dr. Tony Golan, who's the editor-in-chief. The first question is, every few weeks I end up sputtering on my own saliva, often when I'm with others. Does this mean something is wrong? And Dr. Golan says, it's telling that you're usually with other people when this happens, leaving you red-faced and trying to catch your breath. That's because choking on your own saliva most often occurs when people are talking quickly, laughing, or turning their head. These actions can turn the otherwise simple act of swallowing saliva into inhalation. Embarrassing, but not harmful. Other potential culprits? Post-nasal drip, like from a cold or allergies or dry mouth, which many medications can trigger. Both of these issues make the saliva you do produce thicker and easier to choke on. If dry mouth is to blame, drink more liquids. But also ask your doctor if switching medication might make sense. If none of these approaches help, or if the choking is frequent, see your doctor to rule out health conditions that can affect swallowing. And now there's a second question for Dr. Golan. I wake up every night with numbness and tingling in my hands. My sister says I must have carpal tunnel syndrome. Could she be right? She certainly could be. Spurred by increased pressure within the carpal tunnel, a narrow passage in the wrist containing the median nerve and tendons that run to the hand, carpal tunnel syndrome can also cause your hands to fall asleep when driving or even holding a book. It's more common among women and older adults, but also in people with chronic conditions, like rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, or thyroid problems. It's believed carpal tunnel syndrome can also result from excessive keyboard use, and this motion can definitely aggravate symptoms. Most people with the syndrome only have mild symptoms and can benefit from wearing a carpal tunnel splint, available in drugstores and online, while sleeping or doing activities that lead to symptoms. See your doctor if that approach doesn't bring relief. Other remedies include cortisone injection to reduce inflammation, or minor surgery, which relieves pressure on the median nerve by releasing the carpal tunnel ligament. Now here's an article in the Harvard Women's Health Watch called Boosting Breast Cancer Survival. For a deceptively basic question, the answer held profound implications. Could women with early stage but high-risk breast cancer, which is deemed more likely to spread, improve their odds of avoiding a recurrence and living longer just by taking daily aspirin? Harvard researchers decided to find out. As part of a 534-location clinical trial that tracked participants for up to 6 years, they studied more than 3,000 women, average age 53, who were treated with standard therapies for their cancer. Half were randomly assigned to take 300 milligrams of aspirin a day, while the others took a placebo. But the researchers' hopes were dashed, prompting an early end to the trial, when it became clear there was no difference in survival or recurrence rates between the two groups. The analysis published in the May 2024 issue of JAMA came after some observational studies, which can't produce results as robust as clinical trials, had suggested that women with breast cancer who took aspirin seemed much less likely to die from the disease. This is one of those scientific questions a lot of people wanted answered, said study co-author Dr. Wendy Chen, a breast oncologist at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. The good news about a negative study is it shows that it doesn't make sense to continue barking up this tree. Silver linings were scarce, however. I was disappointed, yes, because I would have loved to find a simple, inexpensive way to improve breast cancer survival rates, says study co-author Dr. Michelle Holmes, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. It would have been wonderful if it worked because aspirin is inexpensive and available all over the world in many places where people can't afford expensive cancer treatments. Scientists sometimes hesitate to publish research with negative findings, but this study's publication should help guide women to more effective therapies and perhaps overall better health. While the clinical trial may have shown aspirin couldn't help women with breast cancer avert recurrence or improve survival, several other evidence-based measures might accomplish those goals. Many women are hungry for such guidance. An estimated 310,000 women were diagnosed with invasive breast cancer in 2024, and more than 42,000 died of it, according to the American Cancer Society, though more than 9 in 10 patients with breast cancer are diagnosed at an early stage, about one quarter will eventually die of metastatic cancer. That is cancer that has spread elsewhere in the body. The risk that breast cancer will come back is based on many factors, including the type and stage of the initial malignancy. About two-thirds of breast cancer cases are diagnosed at a localized stage, before the cancer has spread outside the breast. Nearly all women diagnosed while their breast cancer is still localized will be alive 5 years later. It's natural for women with breast cancer to want to investigate anything they can do. In addition to treatment, to lower the odds of the malignancy returning. Obviously, everyone wants to improve their survival and decrease their chance of recurrence, but it is important to understand what is evidence-based and what is not, Dr. Chen says. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.